All right, so I'm Michael Stonke. In 2005, I wrote a book on OpenSSH. I encourage you to buy it and not read it at this point. It's very outdated, but the money that I get from when you buy it is not outdated. It actually still spends just fine. So please grab a copy today. In 2007, I was one of the people that got the Apple repository off the ground. If you use RHEL or CentOS, you're probably pretty familiar with Apple. There were six other people that were kind of instrumental in getting that going. And that was basically the I was maintaining a ton of packages internally at the company I worked at the time, and I wanted what was available in Fedora available on RHEL, and so that was kind of where this idea of Apple was born. And of course, I work at Puppet Labs now, so that's kind of who I am. I am a director of engineering services, and that is the management leader over quality engineering, quality assurance, release engineering, and security events at Puppet Labs. And I can talk about each one of those if you want. We're going to get into basically release engineering and a little bit of quality engineering in here today. But I really want to talk about science. And I like measuring release engineering with science, and I like using it as science. And what is science? If you actually take a step back, it's the study through observation and experiment. And so what we want to do is observe what we're going to do and experiment on what we're going to do. So we experiment, we watch what happens, we figure out how it works. Now, to start with that, we have to have a hypothesis. So what's the hypothesis in release engineering? The hypothesis is that this build artifact is shippable. I can ship this thing, I hope. Then you need an experiment. How do I test to see if this build artifact is shippable? Well, we're going to build and QA the artifact, and we're going to set up an experiment. So to set up the experiment, we want to start the way that any good science starts, from a well-known point, peer-reviewed point. You want to start with things that are already known so that you can build upon them rather than reinventing everything yourself. So what we start with is something that looks like this. And this is a page taken directly from Jez Humble's Continuous Delivery book. And this is roughly the build pipeline that most software is modeling in one way or another today for release engineering. Now, from this, the interesting part at Puppet Labs is the variable side. How do we control our variables? We want to make sure that our variables are working very well. But before we talk about the variables and how we isolate them and how we control for them and how we understand them, we need to go over our experiment goals. So at Puppet Labs, to build and test an artifact, the goals are basically it needs to happen quickly, it needs to be reproducible, and it needs to be user modifiable. And each one of these is pretty important. Fast is basically how fast can I get feedback to my developers about what's going on. For them, they would like it in about 10 seconds. That's pretty unrealistic. I would like it to happen in 15 minutes to 20 minutes. That's a good goal. And depending on what we're releasing and what the package is and what the artifact is, we can hit that. Sometimes it's much, much longer. And it depends on what kind of software it is, where it's at in the pipeline, how far until it fails, and we'll get into that a little bit more. Reproducible is key, and this is something that we didn't have originally. We had the idea that you were just testing what was on head or what was on the tip of the branch, and that was it. But there are times where you have to go back in time to figure out what changed and how something changed. And for us, this means deterministic composition of experiments or of pipeline runs. And so what we have is basically, we have a JSON language expression of how everything's put together at the time to run through the build system, and you can go back in time from it, and you can check out and keep any build so that you have a way to have this be reproducible. And user-modifiable, what this means is I should not have to call a release engineer or a quality engineer to say, hey, I need to run this exact thing that we just ran, but with this minor change. I need the developers to be able to make those minor changes instead of having to talk to me or talk to my team. It just doesn't scale. It needs to be user serviceable. So developers must be able to make a change and measure it without any intervention. That's basically the goal. So we have two types of variables in the system. If you draw back to your science analogy, we have this independent variable and we have a control variable. The control variables are the ones you want to stay the same run after run after run in your experiment. An independent variable is the thing that you want to measure yourself or modify. You want to control for the independence, I guess. And so the way you do that is by having things be very, very similar. And so our pipeline looks roughly like this, and I apologize for this being a little bit washed out. The top part's the important part anyway. So basically, you have a commit phase, a lint phase, a unit phase, integration phase, system phase, and then for a deployment cycle, you can get into like a canary deployment and then a full deployment, depending on how you do things and how you do your deployments. But the idea is you want small changes and move quickly. And also, the items on the left should happen much faster than the items on the right as you move across the spectrum. And this is designed so that you get fail fast. The faster you can fail, the faster the developer learns what's wrong and can start to address fixing it. So in many companies, you have a pipeline that looks roughly like this. And you might have two or three of these pipelines going at a time. You have kind of your production pipeline, and maybe you have your pipeline next, which has a new version of the operating system underneath it, or a large new feature change instead of a small feature change. This is great, except there's one big problem with us at Puppet Labs trying to follow that, and that's that we're not SaaS. I feel like almost all deployment and engineering methodologies around releasing for the last several years have been around software as a service, and we're definitely not software as a service. We deliver an on-premise product to our customers that makes things, it introduces a level of complexity. I think that's not there with software as a service. If I was there doing SaaS, my variable count, I could control and I could be, very stringent upon. I could have, we deploy on this one OS exactly, we deploy on this one version of this exactly. At a customer site, unfortunately, I don't have those niceties, I guess.
What's that thing in the back?
In the background, it's a streetcar riding on a truck, because obviously that's a delivery model you want for a streetcar. So so our pipelines look more like this, which are just a little bit messed up. So the big challenges of on-premise delivery versus software as a service is the cost of being wrong. In experiments, you want to be able to be wrong often because it gives you valid data. It gives you just as good a data as being right in many cases. Unfortunately, when you're delivering for on-premise software, the cost of being wrong is very high. I either have to be able to ship something else to a customer, or I have to be able to make sure that the user has an ability to take this update. For us, we sell into a lot of enterprise shops. And if we sell you a version of Puppet and it has a bug, and you want to update that, it could be, I have to fill out change control tickets, I have to go through change advisory boards, I have to wait until this upgrade is going to happen or this application has an outage window. And it's not rare to see a 3 to 4 month upgrade cycle for a Puppet infrastructure. And now if there's just one little bug that's the problem with it, that's not great. So the cost of being wrong for us is very high. It doesn't mean we're never wrong. There's also multiple streams we have to support. With software as a service, if you're using Salesforce today, no one's asking you to use Salesforce from a year ago. No, I need to stay on that old version. That'll be amazing. No one asks you to do that. Whereas for us, we have about a 3-year support cycle on our enterprise line, which means that we're running somewhere between 1 and 3 streams simultaneously in terms of supporting for security updates and for enhancements for our paying customers. This means that we have those pipelines in spades. So we have the 3 kind of main pipelines, but as we get into that, you'll see that 3 main pipelines is really a pipe dream. We have many, many. So, and we also have the upgrade matrix. So every time you do a release from being wrong, or you need a patch release or a security release, you now have another row in your upgrade matrix of what I can upgrade from and to. And this becomes multiplicative very quickly. So variables are really what we want to control. And again, if we model this back to software as a service doing continuous delivery, we want to reduce any variable that we can to none. And so that, you know, the obvious ones are things like platform or runtime versions. What's my Java version? What's my Ruby version? What's kind of all the software under the hood? Those are the ones you want to start with in kinds of reducing the variables. For us, some of those are within our confines and some of them are not, because some of them are customer choices. We have a lot of variables. And so I'll get into that very shortly, but our goal here is to isolate the change of what variable is doing what. So if I can isolate the change, I can see what's going on. In particular, how does this one variable changing determine the output or the outcome of my experiment? Is this artifact shippable? Can I ship it? An interesting sidebar on shipping. The QA team basically has a job to not ship. And it's the funniest thing in the world whenever I interview somebody and I say, what's your goal? And they say, you know, to make sure we have the highest quality software. And I'm like, well, really? It's to make sure that you can find all the bugs before somebody else does. And so QA is really trying to not ship software. They want you. They want to tell you, inform you, everything that's wrong with your software so that you can make an informed decision. So it's kind of like not shipping, but so it's, it, what we do is we put the software through through the gauntlet, I guess, of the QA cycle. And that's both in terms of pipelines and in terms of number of tests and breadth of tests. But either way, we want to isolate changes so that we can understand what the one small change is and how it impacts our overall flow and it impacts our overall quality measurement of the software. So just a little bit of background on Puppet Lab's commercial product. Our product consists mainly of the stuff that we write, and that's on the left side, is stuff that we write and author. It's Puppet Factor, Hira, Puppet DB, Puppet Server, there's a Cloud Provisioner, there's a UI component, and M Collective, which is a message bus architecture for communication. And on the right side, we have more stuff that we ship because it enables our software. And that's Ruby and Java and Apache and ActiveMQ and Postgres and Ember, and there's a slew of others that I didn't write up there. But basically, we have a lot of software that we write, and we have a lot of software that we vendor. And vendoring software is terrible. I don't recommend it, but sometimes you have to do it. So we have to pick out our own versions of Ruby and Java and Apache and things like that, which means we also have to watch them for security updates and make sure that when there is a security upstream update, we have to pull that into our software package, get that tested, and get that out to our users as fast as possible. We tried using a lot of the system versions that were available for a long time. Unfortunately, those variables were just too great. When you change Ruby versions between 1.8.5 all the way back on Enterprise Linux 5 and Ruby 2 on Enterprise Linux 7, there's a little bit of behavioral changes between those two. And by a little bit, I mean an ungodly amount. So we've had to kind of stick our own stuff in there to isolate those changes. So we reduced the variables by putting in our vendored software versions and our selected versions of software. However, it does come with a cost, and that's we have to keep up with security updates and packaging those for new targets. OpenSSL is another thing that we have to ship in there because of Apache and ActiveMQ, and that becomes very difficult to keep track of and change symbol versions. And I mean, there's never any security problems with OpenSSL, so it's not a big deal, right? So our commercial product is built up of around 450 GitHub repos. So we start with that, and that's kind of how we have to assemble it. And when I say we want a deterministic build, that means we have to keep track of where roughly that number of repos is for every build. And so luckily there's unique SHAs for every Git repo, so you can just kind of track them in one way. And our testing matrix starts to get built up of a lot of variables. So we have master and agent platforms, and then you can get into a version mismatch. So if I have Puppet version 1 running on a master and version 2 running on an agent, now I've got a multiplicative problem. And then you can get into browser differences as well, just for a simple introduction of a variable that I think a lot of people get, and that's, you know, whether I'm running the UI through Chrome or I'm running it through Safari or through Firefox or IE. And so then, you kind of on top of that, we have all these other variables that are pretty well known and pretty well understood by us at this point. And then you get into some of the more esoteric variables that are a little more interesting. For instance, RPM, just the way that RPM works between Enterprise Linux 4 and Enterprise Linux 7, there are some differences. The header has changed. The way you sign packages has changed. And most of that's abstracted if you're on the right platform, but if you're trying to do things all automated, you have to know that if you sign an RPM package 17 times, it will seg fault. 16, it will not. It's just interesting things about RPM you learn. There's also things like Deb Helper, which has never actually helped anyone. Come on, that's a joke. And then you also get differences between different TAR and TAR implementations. On Solaris, you have BSD TAR. On Mac, you have BSD TAR. You have GNU TAR on Linux platforms, and there are incompatibilities between them, especially in files over certain sizes. So we learn about all of these different variables and have to engineer around them. So this is what our agent platform stuff looks like. This is extremely out of focus, but I like it. You can see basically each one of these is a pool, these are pools of warm cache VMs we can grab for testing. So we have somewhere between 1 and 50 VMs in each one of these pools. We have 50 in Enterprise Linux 6, CentOS, x86, 64, because that platform is used to test in just about every other test scenario we have. Whereas something like Enterprise Linux 4 probably isn't tested nearly as often at this point, just because it's so much older. So we have this pooling engine that has all these things sitting there, and that's how we grab a VM off of our platform, and I'll get into that a little more in a little bit. But to start with, we have 61 agent targets that we're building for. So 61 different variables just to build our software. That's before we start testing. Beyond that, we have 33 master platforms. And so that's where you can run a Puppet Enterprise commercial master. On the open source world, it runs on way more than 33, just in case you're curious. But we test, support, and validate 33. And this is for a release that's coming out in the very, 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 very near future. It might be tomorrow. So there's 61 agents, 33 masters, and that makes 2013 combinations to start with. Beyond that, we have at least two supported versions at all times. So that means I have 4,026 combinations that I can work through. After that, it's really, in this instance, we have five supported versions that you can upgrade from. So now I'm at 10,000 combinations of what I can test. And then if I just say I want to test three different browsers, I'm up to 30,195 test cases, just in terms of a rather simple, simplistic measurement of how we model our variables. Obviously, this isn't something we're going to run. I'm not going to run 31,000 test cases per commit, or 31,000 test pipelines per commit, I guess is more the right way to put it. And then beyond that, it's really, are there really only three browsers you're testing? You're not testing, you know, Safari, Firefox, Chrome. Are they on Linux? Are they on Mac? Because there's differences there. And you can start to get into this thing where you get exponential building of your variable count. And you're literally in the millions without that much thought. And so what we do is we choose things to test that are the most representative for our customers. We know that the majority of our customers run on Enterprise Linux of some form for master. So most of our tests involve EL6 or EL7 masters. What do we do for agents? Well, we test the slew of agents against all of them if we can. And so that means we might have one job in Jenkins that has, you know, 61 targets checking into a master and checking to make sure it can get a catalog. A catalog, for those of you that don't know, is just the instructions for automation set on Puppet. Really, the details of Puppet aren't that important for most of this talk, but I can talk about them all day long if you need me to. So what we start with is the basic pipeline that you're used to seeing from continuous delivery is we have a SHA or a commit. It goes through unit testing, and then we go to packaging. And this is really where the first step of the variable fan just happens. And so we fan out. We run dynamic jobs inside of Jenkins that they go through and build out all of these jobs. And so we get, I think it's about eight jobs, and then each of those jobs has subjobs. So like the RPM task is one of the eight, and then RPM happens on a lot of others. That's not the slide order I thought it was, but that's okay. We're going to come back to that in a second. So yeah, after we have the package building, then we start to see where we're really building out here. And you can see that for RPM, we have all these CentOS, RHEL, Oracle, Scientific, and then we also do AIX's RPMs and SLES's RPMs. And then we have these Fedora builds over here that aren't actually shipped commercially but are built. And for Dev, we have Lucid, Squeeze, Trusty, Precise, and down here we have, kind of Mac, Yosemite and Mavericks and IPS for Solaris. And so all of those kick out and they build packages all at once. And then in about 10, 11 minutes, it'll return and say, yeah, all your packages are there. And they're set up on a distribution server. So they go over to a distribution server, which basically ends up just storing every build we've ever had. There's a lot of disk space on that thing. In one release, or one stream for a release, which happens about a quarter, through a quarter of the year, we end up with about 175 gigabytes of builds. And that's because we do a lot of optimization on hard links where we don't store the same thing more than once. And we have basically content addressable storage in there, so you don't do that. Each build, or each instance of a Puppet Enterprise build is 30 gigabytes. And so 30 gigabytes has to go through the testing system the second it hits. And that's a pretty big amount of data to go grab from one build to another. The build for EL6 may only be 400 megabytes, but when you have all the different platforms and combinations, it ends up being almost 30 gigs. And so we have to figure that out. What we do in certain cases is we build the whole thing, but then just start testing with a couple of them so we don't run them all through the pipelines all at once, because if the first one fails right away, I don't need to start the other 29 or whatever. But all builds are kept, and the compose is deterministic. And when I say compose, I want to go back to this, which is where I thought this slide was. What we have here is we start with a SHA commit, And then we have the packaging job, like I said. And after that, each one of those individual packages, so this could be a package like Puppet, goes through smoke testing and system testing. And then once it passes those, it gets promoted into the main build. And that's this compose step. The compose step is where we take all of the artifacts that are built individually by each of the individual dev teams and kind of the separate authors, and they get mashed into one layer. It's almost like an ISO. If you think about it that way, it's the installable artifact for Puppet Enterprise. And that contains around 50 packages on a master platform and around 20 packages on an agent platform. And then that artifact is what's pushed through the next step of integration, smoke testing, and full integration. And then if you pass that, you move into UI, which then fans out to do perf, scale, soak, and a large environment installation, which is basically scale up testing. And then we go off of into tag, sign, and release if all of those things pass, and there's a manual gate between the green step and the red step. And if you're colorblind, I apologize. The tag is the gate. So basically what we're doing is we're working with two different layers of pipelines. We have kind of the individual artifact here and packaging, and then we have the compressed, the composed here. And the composed has to be deterministic, and that's the thing that I keep talking about. We have to be able to reproduce it, because if we move past that version and then we have to go back to a version to see where a bug was introduced, because it may be that the bug wasn't introduced in Puppet and it wasn't introduced in M Collective, but it was introduced when we have this version of Puppet and this version of M Collective working together. And that does happen at times, and we have to be able to basically do the equivalent of a git bisect to find that. And so the way we version this is using git describe in a central repo that has all the JSON blobs to talk about what SHA everything is at and where it is. Okay. And so basically what it comes down to is a lot of indirection. And this is one of my favorite quotes in computer science by David Wheeler, a British computer scientist. But, you know, it's the old saying that all problems in computer science can be solved with another layer of indirection, and then except for too many layers of indirection. And this is where I quickly find that Puppet lives, is because we write the abstraction layer over service managers and over package managers and over user management. That's where we end up, is with too many abstractions, and digging through them is really difficult to find where the bugs live. But because abstractions are so great at solving problems, we solve our abstraction problems, of course, by writing more abstractions, because that's the way you want to do it. And so if you take a look at our pipeline that I just showed you a little bit, and you zoom out a little bit, it ends up looking a whole lot like the continuous delivery pipeline that we saw in Jez Humble's book, where we really have our component tests, our component packages, and our full suite. And it does move from faster to slower. We're basically trying to model a CD flow without doing complete CD. Every one of these builds is tested automatically and deployed into our test system, but it's not obviously just going to customers. But really, if you zoom out at the right level, this is what's going on, even though it's happening on dozens and dozens and dozens of systems simultaneously. So we're doing our control variables and independent variables. The variables normally are the commit. The commit is what's changed. So if I can just say the only thing that's changed in this build from the last one is one additional commit on factor. That's awesome. What happens sometimes is I have one additional commit on factor, and there was one on Puppet, and there was one on M Collective, and we put in a new OpenSSL version under the hood. So that means we had to rebuild Ruby, and you can get into complex things very quickly. Ideally, we're testing so often that you get very, very small incremental changes going on from the testing. We roll a new commercial build about every 15 minutes in terms of what we're doing in the enterprise on the enterprise side of the pipeline. And that means that every 15 minutes there's a build, and that usually has between one and three commits in it, usually. Most of the time it is one, but there are certain times of day where it can get more than that. So we can sit, as I said earlier, science is a study through observation and experiment. So let's drill into that a little bit more, just besides talking about variables and pipelines. So from an observation standpoint, the first thing is that failure is valid. This is one of the few places in the world where failure is totally acceptable, and that's failure is a valid outcome for any experiment, and that's just raw science, right? Failure is okay. It doesn't mean that you did not get a result. You got a result, and the result is negative. And that is exactly what you want. In this case, if I get a failure, if I get a build that is not shippable, I'm very happy because it means I found it. My customer did not find it. you know, eventually I want to ship something, obviously, but in the early goings, especially, if I find failure, it means my QA team's doing their job, running good automated tests, my developers are doing good jobs defining interactions, so failure is very good. So what we're doing is running about between 2,000 and 3,000 jobs a day in terms of how we're running our pipeline for testing and building. And each one of those has between 1 and roughly 19,000 tests per job, and it depends on where you're at in the pipeline as to what jobs have how many tests. And to keep track of all that, we have somewhere between 8 and 12 Jenkins instances running at all times. I think 8 is the minimum required, and there's about 4 others that are used in kind of the bespoke pipelines, I guess is what I would say, the less used pipelines. From a package building perspective, we're doing about 16,000 package builds a month, and that's only on software that we write. That doesn't count packaging any of the dependencies in terms of things like OpenSSL or Java or Ruby. That's just basically package builds of Puppet, mCollective, Factor, Hira, things like that, PuppetDB. Almost everything is built and tested per commit. This has been something that has been difficult for us to do in terms of capacity management, in terms of what's going on, but we need to. Basically, the feedback for developers is so important that if we can't do it per commit, we have to have a darn good reason why and show, you know, what the cost would be to have the right capacity to be able to do it per commit. So we have a lot of volume going through the system, which I think is kind of what we're watching. Luckily, we've built a lot of tools to help us measure this and help us learn about it. So from a build perspective, we have kind of, you know, where builds have been over the last 12 months. And this is, again, just raw builds of stuff that we author. And this is what's going through the system at all times. And you can see this has dropped off a little bit. And part of that is because there's either less new builds going on or we've just got the automation going a little more humming. So maybe we're under 12,000 for the last month. It also could be because the month wasn't complete when I took that screenshot. So we also keep track of kind of the failure rates and how long each of these builds is taking, 187 seconds, 151 seconds. You know, if these get really out of bounds, we have a capacity management problem, and we don't run on an Elastic Cloud, so I have to keep that managed as well. So we have basically, you know, what type of package, deb, RPM, gem, a DMG, how long each one of them takes, and then what builders are getting hit and the percentage of builds that go to each builder so that we can keep track of how many builders we need and what that pipeline and capacity looks like. And then we have one of the things that I really try and measure is what's being self-serviced by developers versus what's requiring release engineering interaction. And like these two guys work on the release engineering team and they're doing a few builds. Most of these are probably very early on when they're doing testing of how something's going to be built versus it actually being built for a pipeline run or a production run. But you can see that Jenkins is definitely the person doing most of the work, and that means that's developers kicking things off using a defined workflow, which is amazing because that means they're not talking to me. It's not that I don't like developers, I'd just rather talk about something else. So again, this kind of shows that Jenkins is doing way more of the work than any other release engineering team. And then you also get into health of the system. And this is the way more difficult part than dealing with the volume, is actually making sure that the experiments can either succeed or fail. If your experiments just abort, you have wasted time, you've wasted CPU cycles, you've wasted things for everyone. So we've written several tools to kind of introspect Jenkins and our build farm environment to figure out really where things are at. This one's called Clockin. This one's called Wayland, I'm sorry. I forgot, these two look almost the same now. And this is basically the heads-up dashboard that's in all of the developer areas. And so this is probably the Puppet Factor team, it looks like. Yeah, this is the core team, their dashboard. And so you can see kind of what's running. You can click the Investigate button. It'll take you right to the Jenkins page with the problem in the last run. And, you know, it gives you kind of a drill down into each one of the different things that are going on in terms of the build and testing time. Clockin is kind of the health of the overall testing system, which gives us how many runs have executed, what's queued, and then this failure rate over here is what I usually pay a lot of attention to. You know, if we're getting failure rates above 10%, I like to know why and what's going on. It could be that developers are writing really bad code, they're introducing a brand new feature right now that has test coverage that hasn't been run before, and so we don't know if the tests are very good or not yet. Or it could be that the NTP server is down, and so we're unable to sync, and so SSL certificate handshaking is failing. And sometimes that's not the greatest. We try and get those to categorize into the abort role, but you have to do some manual triggers to make sure that it registers as an abort versus a failure. And so infrastructure failures versus testing failures are extremely difficult to tell the difference between the two of them, and that's really a goal, is you want to tell the difference between experiment unable to run versus experiment ran and gave you a terrible output, which is totally valid. So, yeah, like I said, this is the thing that I'm paying a lot of attention to. It's just what our failure rate is, and it's kind of like uptime where it gives you the last 1 hour, 4 hours, and it just keeps giving you more and more over time. And these are probably actually actual numbers. Actually, I'm sure they are for a one time, and I think it's because we were working on moving to a new system for part of this during this time. We also look at queue trends, and that's, you know, how many tests and how many pipelines are sitting there backed up and queued. We want to make sure that those are not too high. Between 1 and 5 is perfectly acceptable. When you get up to, you know, we have 300 things in the queue right now, manual intervention is probably going to be required. What we don't have is priority queuing, which is something we need to work on, is that certain jobs are more important than others, and they should be able to jump ahead of other jobs in the queue on the global system. We don't have that yet, and that's one of the things we'll be working on next. This is basically just a different view of Clockin, talking about how we understand what each Jenkins is doing for us. You know, how many changes are there? How many blocked runs are there? You know, what's building right now? Obviously, this was taken during a pretty low time, but this is new for us as well. The other thing we do is we measure the heck out of times of tests and times of how long things take, and we dump it all into Graphite, which I'm sure a lot of people are doing these days. But we categorize them as to, are they unit runs or are they integration runs? Is it performance or packaging? And again, when things go way out of bounds, we can figure out, you know, is there a storage I/O hiccup going on? Is there something going on the wrong side of the pipeline? And eventually you end up looking at a team that looks much more like SREs than just quality engineers for trying to maintain this pipeline system. You know, the monitoring is just as important as the data going through it. We also have some of the failures here that you can see, like when a line goes totally red, like what happened there. And I think in that instance, this was kind of earlier on, GitHub went down. And when GitHub is down, things stink in terms of trying to clone projects from GitHub. So what do you learn from that? Don't rely on somebody that's not you. So we start working on things like that. You know, GitHub went down. We used to have timeouts with RubyGems. Probably 1 out of every 9 or 11 calls would fail going out to RubyGems.org. And so we would basically just start having to look at what are the problems here externally that we're relying upon. And so let's talk about what we've learned along the way in terms of trying to perform these experiments, or a segment that I like to call worst practices. They're way more fun than best practices. Lost assumptions. And this is kind of where we get back to, you made assumptions and you didn't know it. You had a variable that you thought was stable and is not. External services is the most is the flagship out of those. And that's things like, I'm relying on GitHub. And if GitHub is down, my entire pipeline fails. So, you know, we quickly started building mirrors of all of our Git hooks. We put post receive hooks on our GitHub repos, and they all mirror internally, so that we don't have this reliance on GitHub, because GitHub gets DDoSed a lot. I don't know if you guys know this, but they host some political content there, and therefore they get very much DDoSed. And also things like RubyGems was just very unreliable for about the last 9 months until about 3 months ago when they redid a lot of the infrastructure. And now our failure rates on RubyGems are way, way better than they've ever been. However, we still have a mirror internally and we run our own gem server internally now. We do the same thing with package mirrors because you never know when there's going to be a metadata corruption on something like EPL or Debian upstream proper or whatever. And when you run on 61 different targets that all have different package managers, the chances of one of those having a corrupt time during that run is actually pretty high. We were finding that it happened about between 1 in 5 and 1 in 7 runs, we had package metadata corruption, whether it was from upstream. And so we started mirroring all that internally and actually making atomic commits to move over so that you weren't hitting, like, metadata had updated, but the packages hadn't synced in a mirror yet, the way, like, Mirror Manager works for EPL and things like that. So, at this scale, you start to uncover, I guess, where a lot of the problems have been swept under the rug, I guess, for a lot of these metadata maintenance. And you also kind of get into how do you monitor the system that's monitoring things, because if the monitoring is down, you have a problem. Like, if I'm not measuring the pipeline and measuring the effectiveness of it, it's not alerting me, but is it not alerting me because everything's okay, or is it not alerting me because that monitoring system has failed? And so you have to kind of get into the who watches the watchers loop, and it's turtles all the way down, and it doesn't work out very well. But that's one of the kind of the SRE type roles that's happened in our pipeline. In terms of other spectacular failures, we had a segment of our code base, this was about 2 years ago, that unit tests, if they passed, exited zero. And if they failed, they exited zero. That's very bad. So it took us a while to learn that because it wouldn't always turn up in integration tests because we weren't exercising every single code path in all the integration tests, especially the early smoke tests. And that took a while to learn. And, you know, those are just stupid mistakes, I guess, that we all learn from and move on. And I can kind of laugh about now and still feel very upset about it. Submodules are another thing. We use Git exclusively for our version control, and we used to do submodules. And we used to have about 60 to 80 submodules in our master commercial branch, and trying to get multiple people to understand working with submodules in terms of you need to commit in the main repo and in the submodule repo when you want to make a change, things got out of sync very, very quickly. You'd find that somebody had a tag on their laptop that hadn't been pushed up to the remote, and we basically got away from that. And the way we got away from that is doing a JSON collection of how we have what SHA and what version for all the software. So it's almost a re-implementation of submodules, but apparently it's mentally easier to model from people. Everything having to do with AIX is terrible. So, I actually like AIX as a system admin. I think their LVM is pretty awesome, and I think that their virtualization stuff was really cool. But from trying to build and automate their pipelines and testing things, it is nuts. You know, we tried to make it so you could re-image everything on commit and have an LPAR spin up so that you could do all these tests. And, you know, we looked at using WPARs and just a bunch of other ways of doing things with AIX. And the way we have it now is I'm nowhere near satisfied. It takes about 35 minutes to run our basic set of tests on AIX. And on most of the other platforms, it's about 6. So it's pretty not okay in terms of, but I need to make sure I have a pristine environment and I need to be able to reset it. And, you know, we looked at LVM snapshots. We looked at getting hosted through IBM, getting like their AIX cloud. And I don't know if you guys have ever played with that, but don't. So basically, some of these, you know, some of the stuff that doesn't work with like VMware or EC2, you get into a much more challenging way of how do you automate it into your pipeline. And AIX is kind of our poster child for difficulty. Solaris on Spark is right up there, but it's not as bad. Or, you know, some of the Mac stuff can be pretty bad if you can't put it in VMware, and certain things you can and certain things you can't. The other problem we really have is data duplication, and that's this build data, kind of the pipeline. How does it coordinate across? And we have some data is in 8 spots and some's in 1, and we're not very good at rectifying that yet. We're still definitely working on fixing that up. Visualizing the pipeline is another very, very difficult thing that we're still working through, and that's a developer has a commit. Where is that commit in the overall testing cycle? Is it in a release? Is it in this build? Did it not make it into this build? It's really easy to know if your commit's in Puppet because you can look at Puppet. It's really difficult to know if that version of Puppet was the version chosen by the next commercial build that went out that had the entire, all of our software mashed onto an ISO. And so that's one of the things that we're really working on is just visualizing and change tracking for that. Pipeline availability has been a huge problem in the past. We just basically went through a giant upgrade of hardware on the back end, which has really, really alleviated that problem. It's amazing what having the right number of CPUs and memory will do for your overall pipeline. But along that, capacity planning is very difficult for what we do. And that's, we have trends for a current release, but the next release could have a feature set that is doing something very different. You know, if this release was heavy on Ruby on the client side and the next release is heavy on Clojure on the server side, it's a very different usage pattern for what we need in terms of capacity to run through all these tests. And beyond that, certain tests have to have, you know, 8 or 10 nodes in them to even run, and some of them only have to have 1 node to run. And so we kind of have capacity planning difficulties. You know, we can make some kind of high-level abstraction and guesses, but we're not very good at actually being right on the money. And I guess that's one of the bigger challenges we have. So in summary, I guess what we do is we hypothesize a lot that our builds are shippable, and we fail a whole lot that our builds are not, or we find out a whole lot that our builds are not shippable. The experiment is the pipeline, right? And the experiment is I can build this, I can test it, and I can get it through. And that's how we control our variables. And the way that we do that, you know, with abstractions, as I talked about, kind of the way we abstract the pipelines away so that you can look at them in a common way, more like a continuous delivery flow, even though they're definitely not doing continuous delivery. And we also abstract, even at the test layer, you know, is this systemd versus is this, you know, run it versus is this upstart for a service management. And all of that has to get all abstracted away as well. So we have abstractions on abstractions on abstractions for how we do our testing and building. Our observations are mostly kind of the outputs that we have on the system and talking about the health, and then we measure that, measuring the capacity of the system. So with that, we have some tools tools that you can check out, and I should have gone into the VM pooler a little bit more, and that was what I went into earlier with all those graphs that were up there. That's a warm cache for VMs. We used to provision each VM as we needed it, and we found that that was adding between 2 and 6 minutes per test run to provision a VM. And so what we do now is we provision them all ahead of time and have a pool sitting there where you can just hit a URI endpoint and it'll give you the VM. And it's an atomic operation, so if you ask for 9 and there's not 9 available, it'll wait and block until there are 9, or give you a return code if you want that, that says it's not good right now. And that's all open source, and that's the VM pooler, and there's a VM pool CLI thing going on top of it. The packaging repo is it's a set of Puppet code that drops on top of all of your or on top of your systems to build out our builders. So our builders are all open source the way we do all of our building, which is RPM and Deb and Mac and Solaris, and DAX stuff is probably open source, but probably not very useful for anybody. And then we have the packaging repo, which is an abstraction layer for developers that sits on top of that, which is basically a set of rake tasks that say, rake, I want to package this thing, and it will go off to all available targets in the build data. And then Clockin is kind of the overall Jenkins health measurement tool, which is not quite open source by us yet, but it will be very soon. I know the lead developer is working on it. He wants to take out some of the site-specific data that's in there and make it abstracted just a little bit so you can have a config file instead of hard-coding Puppet Labs everywhere. But that's basically the work we have left to do. So yeah, that's basically what I have about science and release engineering and how we deliver software at Puppet Labs. I guess I have time for maybe one question. Yeah.
I was curious, is Puppet Labs
open
source and also?
Yeah, so the question was, is Puppet moving to a Java-based code base, and what challenges are we having with that? Puppet is moving languages. It's moving away from Ruby primarily. On the server side, we're moving to Clojure, which is a Lisp dialect on the JVM, but is not Java. And on the agent side, we're moving to C++. And so basically, we want to have a small, very small, lightweight, fast agent. And we're still going to have Ruby bindings for everything, so you'll still be able to have all your Ruby API compatibility layer will still totally be there. So if you're writing Ruby, please don't get upset about it. It'll work. The challenges that we're having are the compile chain, like switching to compiled stuff has definitely been a change from the way Ruby works in terms of having to get the right versions of GCC, the right versions of libboost in there and things like that. That's been a new thing to learn how to vendor and how to manage using CMake and AutoTools instead of kind of using the Ruby rake paradigm that was pretty simple. Server side, it really hasn't been bad at all. We've been doing it for a while with PuppetDB. So we already had Clojure in the stack, and it works out really well. And it actually uses the amount of memory you limit it to instead of Ruby, which just grabs all the memory that it will ever ask for and then use more. So anyway, I'm happy to talk about anything Puppet Labs related to if you guys need me in the hallway or anything. So thanks.